Our Bible reading this evening is taken from the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, and we're going to start reading at chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37 begins to introduce us to the individual that we're going to be thinking about for the next period of time, this man Joseph. And we're going to learn about some of what the early information of the Bible gives to us about Joseph in these words of Genesis chapter 37. We're going to read from the beginning, and we're going to read the whole chapter. This is the word of God. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age. And he made him an ornate robe. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said to him, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" He replied, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks?" "They've moved on from here," the man said. "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes a dreamer," they said to each other. "Now come, let's kill him and throw him in one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into this cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of the robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty, and there was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up from the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. examine it to see whether it is your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him, and Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. All the sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Well, please do, if you have a Bible with you, turn to Genesis chapter 37 this evening. You may want to turn on your mobile phones, if you've got a Bible app, to chapter 37 to keep especially the first 11 or so verses before you as we study what these verses have to say to us. We learn, you can learn just as I did in the last few days, reminding myself of geography lessons of many years ago. We learn that before volcanoes tend to erupt, there are heightened seismic activity that is noted in the times before the eruption. So that seismic activity might take the forms of small tremors or perhaps even semi-substantial earthquakes. There may be some of the seismic activity that occasionally some smoke might be seen coming out off a volcano. But all of that is a sign that the pressure is building within the Earth's core, and that pressure is building to such a point at which it is going to explode. And when that volcano erupts, the landscape is going to be dramatically and permanently changed. I want you to keep in your mind's eye for a few moments as we begin tonight that whole notion of a growing pressure that is about to erupt. Because that is what we encounter when we think of Genesis chapter 37 here. That's what we encounter when we meet Joseph. Because Joseph, in his life, in his family here, there is a situation that is about to have the top blown off it. And the landscape is going to look very, very different after this takes place. Now, when we think of Joseph, we're thinking about a Bible story that is perhaps one of the most famous Bible stories that we have. It is one that has been turned into various different well-known poems. I think it was George Herbert that wrote a very famous poem about Joseph's coat. It's been turned into West End musicals that broke multiple records with Joseph and his amazing Technicolor dream coat. Because the account of Joseph, it has all the ingredients for a gripping drama. Because you have jealousy, and you have deceit, and you have imprisonment, lust, you have forgiveness, you've got multiple layers of tragedy, and yet within this tragedy, there's somebody that we meet who manages to thrive even through all of the variety of desperate circumstances he finds himself in. This is no Pixar movie from Disney that's just some tale with a happy ending. This is real life. And so this evening, as we begin to think about Joseph, tonight is in many ways the pilot episode. As we think of the life and times of this man, Joseph, as we try and acquaint ourselves with some of the markers on this route, the plot that's about to unfold, and as we crucially also identify the invisible hand that is at work behind the scenes in this passage here. And I say that invisible hand because that's really quite important, because it could be possible for somebody to read the account of Joseph and to be moved in different ways, that our emotions might be stirred within us. We might feel sorrow about the rejection that he faced. We might have a degree of admiration at his stoic resolve to be able to deal with the different things that life throws at him. We might be empathizing with him as he takes one step forward but two steps back. We might have a sense of joy as we think of him being transformed from a prison to a palace. And we could analyze all these elements of Joseph's life and yet miss the crucial reason that this man, Joseph, has more chapters of this first book of the Bible devoted to him than anybody else in this book. Because what's going on here with Joseph is not just simply a story of a family dynamic that's gone wrong. But you have a story here, an account here of Joseph that is connected to what's gone before and is connected to what will come after. And so for our pilot episode tonight, we're going to rewind first of all, and then we're going to fast forward before we press play and analyze what this passage is saying to us this evening. Let's rewind. We don't need to rewind far. If you've got one of these Sky digital remote controls, you need to get different speeds for fast-forwarding, for rewinding. You're only on speed number 2 as you rewind here, because we've only reached 30-odd chapters in this book of Genesis. And we've learned about the origins of human history. We've learned about the God who has called things into existence. And we've learned about the God who has chosen to make himself known to us by dealing with a particular family in such a way that we can trace key elements of promises that God has made. Now, that particular family was had at its head this man, Abraham. And this man, Abraham, was given a number of different promises. He was given promises that from him and from his, at that point, non-existent family, from him a nation would come. And on top of that, that nation would bring blessing for the rest of the nations on the earth. And from that non-existent family that he had at that point would come a king who would rule in the best way possible. And so what we see in Joseph are some of the promises that God has given to Abraham actually beginning to come true. So we see that it is through Joseph that this promised line that God has selected, that the nations of the world start to be blessed. Because it wasn't simply the people of God who found themselves being looked after in a time of famine. There were countless millions of people who benefited, not simply in Egypt, but in the countries round about, the nations round about benefited from Joseph's ability to manage that crisis. It was under Joseph's legacy that this family line becomes a nation. And it was the first time that the conversation could be had about whether or not that promise of a ruler, of a king, coming from Abraham's line, whether or not this might be the one who was promised. And so when we think of Joseph, the life and times of Joseph, we rewind to realize that he is coming as a fulfillment of promise. God that has begun to fulfill his promises to Abraham. But more than that, we need to fast forward. And if you've got your remote control, you're fast-forwarding as fast as you can, because we're going thousands of years into the future. We're at plus 32 or times 32 speed to find out what's going on here with Joseph connected to the future. And we begin thinking about that connection to the future by asking a question that was asked of Jesus. Jesus was asked, "Are you the one that we've been waiting for, or is another going to come?" Now, it was John the Baptist that sent messengers to ask that question of Jesus. But in one sense, it could be asked of Joseph. And Joseph could have said, "No, I'm not actually that promised one." But there are, in the painting that God gives to us, in the account of Joseph, there are in the broad brushstrokes of Joseph's life, as well as in the finer details of Joseph's life, glimpses and links and pointers to the one who would ultimately fulfill all of the covenant promises of God. Well, what would some of these broad brush strokes actually look like? Well, he is the one in whom, Jesus Christ is the one who ultimately the promises of God will be fulfilled in. He is the one who ultimately all the nations of the world and all the peoples of the world, male, female, young, old, rich, poor, from whatever nationality, whatever language, whatever culture, can benefit from the blessing that's found in Jesus Christ. He is the one who is the fulfillment of all of this, that we can all rest completely safe under the rule of this promised King and Savior who could come and who would come and who we would follow in time and in eternity. So there's little glimpses, little links, little hints in Joseph's life that we see in broad brushstrokes that can point us to Jesus. But also some of the finer details that we can think of Joseph's life along with Jesus' life. Both of them were loved by their father. Both of them were abandoned by those who should be caring for them. Both of them had their lives sold for money. Both of them found themselves surrounded on either side by criminals. Joseph in prison, Jesus on the cross. And both of them prophesied that one out of the two of these, either in the prison or on the cross, would know the salvation, the transformation work of God. And these finer details, we see some of the similarities between Jesus and Joseph. But we also see in some of the finer details some of the contrasts between Jesus and Joseph. Because for Joseph, the experience that he went through was not one that he chose to go through. So he didn't choose to be abandoned by his brothers. He didn't choose to end up in a pit or in a prison before he ended up in a palace. He was very much somebody who was going through this involuntarily. And yet Jesus, who ended up in a deeper pit, and Jesus, who ended up with a worse sense of abandonment than even Joseph did, he voluntarily found himself in that set of circumstances. Because he knew, in leaving the glory of heaven above, he knew that this is what was going to be involved for him to fulfill the purposes and promises of God, to deal with the clear and present danger that humanity has had since the very beginning. And that is the danger that sin causes, which is not simply physical death, but eternal death. The only way that could be dealt with was for Jesus to know that sense of abandonment. For Jesus to have that coat of the Father's love ripped from him. So that on the cross he cries, my God, why have you forsaken me? He voluntarily put himself into that mission that would fulfill every promise of God for people like me and for people like you. So in many ways, the story of Joseph is in miniature the story of the Bible. It is a story of glory through suffering. It is a story of exaltation through humiliation. And it is the story, the account of how God is working sovereignly as only he can to fulfill every one of his promises, even when it seems to the reader that it's impossible. How can God possibly work out what is evil in this world? How can he work it out for good? Well, that's what we're going to examine through the number of episodes as we study the life of Joseph. We're going to see how God manages to do this in a way that only he can. So if we've rewound and we fast forwarded to see how Joseph fits in to the whole message of the Bible, let's now press play and let's go back to this building pressure, this eruption that is about to take place, and let's find out what this eruption is all about. Well, we begin by noting that the eruption in this family is caused by history repeating itself. The eruption that we have here is crystallized for us in verse 3. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Verse 4 tells us the other sons knew it. I see history repeating itself because Jacob, or Israel as he was renamed, he was somebody who lived himself without that affection, without that love, without that approval from his own father. His father favored his brother. And so Jacob knew what it was to be on the end of being favored by one parent over another. And as is so often the case, he himself parents as he was parented. And so that troublesome family trait comes down the line. Now, for those of us who are parents today and perhaps had different positive and negative ways that we were parented, and we think that we're duty-bound, that history repeats itself, there's nothing we can do about it, we can. We can be aware of certain things, and we can make a point of trying to ensure we don't fall into that same trap. But you may ask the question, if you're new to the story of Joseph, why did he favor Joseph over all these other sons? Didn't he have 12? Well, he did. And you can read for yourself why he favored Joseph. Joseph was born to his favorite wife. Yes, there were more than one, very different time to the time that we're living in. There was more than one. It was the classic love story of unrequited love. They couldn't get together when they wanted to. But eventually, Jacob managed to have the woman that he loved. But she was unable to bear any children until later in life, when Joseph was born. And then she would go on to bear another child called Benjamin, but she would tragically die in giving birth. So as Jacob thinks of his favorite wife, and he looks up at this son, Joseph, that has been born to him in his old age, he sees something of his precious wife. And he very unhealthily sets the center of his own emotional life on Joseph. And Joseph becomes the center of his life. He's the one that gives him that joy. He's the one who gives him that sense of completion. And he does so in a way that ostracizes the rest of the family. And so, where the family are out working, Joseph is at home. While Joseph is loved, the rest of, and he's loved and he's named in this passage, the rest of them are just the sons of these other women. They're not even named. When they go about wearing their clothes in the charity shop, he's the guy with the designer gear. He has the love and affection of a father, and yet Joseph has the hatred of his brothers. But somebody may turn around and say, well, that's not a bit unfair, Alistair, because, you know, didn't Reuben, his firstborn son, didn't he almost betray that privileged position of being a firstborn son by the silliness of his behavior in chapter 35? You can read it for yourself. In one sense, that's true. He did almost disqualify himself as being the firstborn son because of what he's done. And so was Jacob not merely selecting a new firstborn? Well, no, he wasn't. Because there was no excuse for him to somehow mistreat the other sons that he had, let alone the daughters he had, with the favoritism there. And so that's been the position that's been there. But the tremors are getting worse. The earthquake, or the earth is beginning to shake that a little bit more. There's more steam coming out because two things have happened. And we learn of these two things in verse 2 and then in verse 5 onwards. In verse 2, we learn that Joseph is something of a telltale. He's something of a snitch. He's the one who comes and he gives a bad report about his brothers to his father. Now, the original language here tells us that the word report is something negative. And so the implication is that the way in which he has conveyed this report is that it's not exactly been entirely truthful. Some of what took place might actually have been true, but it's exaggerated. It's been built up, it's been twisted to make his brothers look worse than they actually are. So that's hardly likely to endear himself to his brothers. Well, you've read the passage, you know it didn't. The second tremor would be these dreams. And as we encounter these dreams, we almost ask the question, well, where is God in all of this? Where is God in this chapter where he's not mentioned directly? Well, the answer is God is in the dreams. God is the one who sends these dreams. Now, the context of these dreams, or the content rather of these dreams, are really quite shocking for those who've heard it. Because you've got all the people in Joseph's family, they're going to bow down to him. Even his father and mother are allegedly going to bow down to him. And for the time that Joseph lived, that was just completely breaking all cultural norms. The elder never bows before the younger. In fact, that would be almost a shameful thing to do. Joseph, you're expecting us? Now, we are going to somehow bow before you? Who do you think you are? Now, we don't know whether it was naivety, whether it was arrogance, whether he was pathologically insensitive to the impact of his words, but he shares these dreams. And dreams are going to be quite important in this account of Joseph. And we're going to learn as we study this account that when there are two dreams that come, that is emphasizing the message is coming from God, and it's a message that most certainly will happen. One of the byproducts of the confusion of our own day with everything that's going on with the virus is that lots of people are having really vivid and unsettling dreams just now. There was an article I read the other day about this. There's three particular types of dreams that people are having, and there's reasons for it. And certain sleep experts will be saying it, that we're not waking up to alarm clocks and various different routines. I want to just make clear, when I'm talking about dreams just now, I'm not talking about the dreams you're having or the dreams I may be having, however wild and wacky they may be and however frequent they may be. I'm talking about dreams in the context of the Bible. Because in the first part of this book of Genesis, God is speaking through angelic beings. He's communicating in a very special way. From this point onwards, God starts to speak to his people in dreams. And what's taking place is explained for us later on in the Bible in Hebrews chapter 1. And I want to read this for you because this is really important. It says, "In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets in many times and in various ways, including dreams. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son." He's spoken to us by his Son, whose words are recorded for us in the Bible, the revelation of which is given by God for us to know what God wants us to do. So the dreams you and I may be having, very different to the dreams that Joseph was having. But these dreams tell us that not simply is God involved, but these dreams tell us that God knows the outcome is absolutely certain. That God knows that what he is saying in these dreams is going to come true. The brothers may reject this message. In fact, they did reject this message. They had no notion as to whether they had any right to reject this message, but they did. Here's the thing. They can reject the message of God all they like. They cannot escape the message of God, however. And even though we're communicated to in a different way in our generation, we're communicated, God speaks to us by his Son, as he is revealed to us by the Spirit and the Word of God. We might not necessarily accept the message, but we cannot escape it. Because what God says comes true. God's will most certainly does come to pass. And nobody and nothing can thwart that. And things that surprise us don't surprise God. And so this dream tells us that God knew the outcome of the account of Joseph. It's very interesting. On a number of occasions moving forward in the different installments of this series and different episodes, we're going to see that these brothers remembered these dreams. And these brothers ended up living this dream because God had sent it. But the tremors of Joseph being a snitch, being a telltale, being an informant, as well as this dream, means that pressure is building and building and building. And so three times in these words, you have it noted that the brothers hate Joseph. In the Bible, if something is repeated quite close together, it's for emphasis. In other words, don't miss this. If it's repeated a second time, you know this is crystal clear. They were not simply irritated. They were not simply put out. There was an intensity to the hatred they had for their brother. So that's something about the life and times of Joseph. Something of the markers that we're going to encounter moving forward. Something of the invisible hand who's at work. Let me finish off tonight by bringing out three truths that we can apply to our own lives this evening. Truth number one, it does not matter how dysfunctional you may think your life is tonight. Dysfunctional in your marriage, your family, dysfunctional with your relationships on other levels, dysfunctional work-wise, dysfunctional even on your spiritual life. It does not matter how dysfunctional you would describe your life this evening, that is not a sign that God is somehow absent. Nor is it a sign that God is somehow inactive. Because the dysfunctional family that we meet here in chapter 37 reminds us that God is aware and is active even through all the levels of dysfunction that are taking place. Even through all the brokenness of the relationships that were present there, even through the growing sinful hold that pride, jealousy, hatred was having on some of the characters within this story, God is still able, because God is sovereign and God is in ultimate control, he's able to still work through all of the dysfunction, all of the tangled mess of that situation and of our situations in life to accomplish his purposes for the good of his people, for the glory of his name. It does not matter how complex our circumstances may appear to us. The God who is sovereign and whose providential rule is unrivaled is still able and willing to be working in and through all of these different issues to accomplish what he wants to accomplish in us, as well as to accomplish what he wants to accomplish on a global level. The dysfunction of your situation does not disqualify you from the input of God in your life. Be encouraged tonight. The second truth that we learn here is that God was working in Joseph's life in a remarkable way. Because as we are introduced to Joseph, if you know anything of the end of the story of Joseph, and you realize that this guy is going to be second in command of the world's largest superpower of the day, he's going to be the prime minister, he's going to rise to a prominence in a foreign land, he's going to have a control that very few people in the Bible are ever going to have. And you think of where you start off in chapter 37, and you think of where he got to, you realize it's not because of latent abilities within Joseph that somehow came to light in extreme circumstances that enabled him to get to that position, because there was nothing in the family or emotional carnage almost that he grew up in that would somehow give an indication that he was going to be used by God in this way. Rather, what we see is that God is using somebody in the most unlikely circumstances to accomplish great things, because God is working in his life. And he's working in his life in the pit, as we're going to see next time, as well as when he's in the palace. God is working in his life to make him the person that he wants him to be, because God is a gracious God. And God is a God who works to mold and to shape and to change every one of his people. One person famously used an illustration like this. He said, imagine that you are a living house and that God has come to somehow take up residence in this house. And you know that there's some work to be done in this house. You know there's certain things that need to be addressed. And in the analogy, you know that the drains, pipes may need to be fixed. You know that there may be a leak here or two. You know there may be a bit of a window that might need to be, window pane that might need to be replaced. Some of these things that are quite obvious, perhaps from the outside, they need to be addressed. And God goes about doing that. And we could liken that to, you know, certain places that we perhaps go to that we know we shouldn't, or certain websites that we watch that we know we shouldn't do, or certain other things that we do that we know really at the very start of God working in our lives, they need to be put to one side. But you see, God doesn't stop there with the living house image. Because God starts then to start working in the house in a way that's really quite painful and can be really quite bemusing. And so God starts knocking walls down. And God starts putting an extension in one part of the building, and he adds another floor, and he builds a courtyard, and he builds a tower. Because what we think God is doing in our lives is that he's going to make us into this nice, quaint little cottage that perhaps we might be. But that's not what God's doing. God is going to mold us and make us and turn us into a palace, because he himself has come to take up residence in our lives. And so what happens when we take the building analogy to our life analogy, when we go through the circumstances that we cannot understand why, and we would never choose to find ourselves in some of the pits of despair that we end up in, and we would never dream of wanting to be literally at the end of our tether trying to figure out what to do next, God is working in all of these things to make us the palace that he wants us to be. And in Joseph, we see what that palace was like beforehand. And as the chapters go on, we'll see the renovation work taking place. And we'll learn that that is what God does, not simply to Joseph, but it's what God does for you and for me as well. That he doesn't just simply tinker around the edges of our existence. God wants us to be the people he wants us to be. And then finally, we see that this man, Jacob, he teaches us two things. He teaches us, number one, the folly of making any individual the central point of our emotional love and joy in this life. Because no individual in our family, or out with our family at this point in time, no individual can fulfill that role. It's a role that only God should have. But Joseph does say something positive. Sorry, Jacob does give us something positive. And that is in verse 11. In the aftermath of this dream that Joseph has been speaking, and Jacob's had to pull him up over it, and he's had to rebuke him. It tells us at the end of chapter verse 11, his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. What does that say? It says Jacob didn't dismiss it. He had to intervene, but he didn't dismiss what was taking place, because he knew there must be something behind it. And just as years later with Mary, the mother of Jesus, as she encounters so many different reactions to the birth of her son and different reactions to her son himself, she cherishes these things. She lays these things up in her heart. She doesn't understand, but she knows God's at work, and she's trusting. And in that, there's a lesson for us. There's a lesson for us that we can be so very simplistic. X is happening because of Y. And we conclude that we somehow are in sync with the purposes of God, because it just makes so much sense, doesn't it? A lot of the time, we just need to stop. A lot of the time, we just need to keep these things in our minds rather than verbalizing them. Because as much as we think we may know what God is doing, often that's not the case. In finishing off then tonight, our time is gone. The tremors are beginning to come. The brothers don't like this message. They don't like the messenger. But the brothers cannot somehow stop what's going to take place. Tonight, don't be like them. The message of Jesus is a message that exposes us. It tells us we've got something missing. What we have missing is a relationship with God based on a faith in Jesus who lived and who died for us. For the brothers here, you could almost imagine if you were a director and you're trying to film this episode here, just before the eruption takes place, you could almost have the camera beginning to shake. The worried looks on maybe Jacob's face that something's about to take place. because the eruption is coming. And next time, God spares us, we're going to think of that eruption as we think of the rest of chapter 37 as to what happened to Joseph.